This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In his 1993 bestseller, Listening to Prozac, my guest Peter Kramer considered the impact of antidepressants on people's sense of self. In his new book, Against Depression, Kramer writes about why depression needs to be taken seriously as a disease and treated with medication, just like any other disease. He also explains what recent research is teaching us about the biochemical nature of depression and what clues that offers about potential new medications. Kramer is a clinical professor of psychiatry at Brown University. According to Kramer, one reason why many people are reluctant to treat depression like a disease is that we associate it with artistic inclinations and sensitivity, traits we admire. You say in your book that people are always saying to you, but if we did away with depression, would we have had a Van Gogh? What do they mean by that?
I think the worry is that depression is related to creativity and in some way that benefits the culture, so that if artists were, say, happy, we would not have some ballast for what is really an acquisitive, happiness-oriented society. And I think that objection mistakes what depression is. I think depression has declared itself to be a disease, and that people who are not depressed have a full range of emotion and, in particular, a full possibility of experiencing suffering.
Do you think if we did away with depression that we would be doing away with a certain level of introspection and reflection? And we'd be doing away with introspection and reflection that we find in the arts? I mean, I think that is one of the fears, you know, that a lot of people do think that, like, depression and writing or depression and painting are linked in some way. And in part, people believe that because there are so many people prone to depression who are our writers and our artists.
Well, I have, I think, a complex response to this. And I think to understand the answer, one has to have some sense of what depression is as a disease, what sort of disease it is. But the short answer is, I think, first of all, that optimists can be very thoughtful. They are capable of ambiguity. They're capable of depth. They know that the human condition is perilous. So I think one does not have to be even a pessimist, much less someone who's depressed, in order to understand life's complexity. So that's one sort of answer. But the other sort of answer is that it really depends how we would do away with depression. If we could stop the pathway to depression at the very last step so that one could experience losses, one could experience pain, one could even have the genetics that make one vulnerable to depression, and the last step in the link would be broken, the last link in the chain would be broken, so that one actually never had damage to the brain, one never fell into these very narrow mood states that last for months and even years. In that case, of course, eliminating depression would allow us to be highly neurotic. It would allow us to be highly ambivalent and, you know, somewhat paralyzed without being depressed. And in effect, the treatment for depression would make the world safe for neurotics or safe for depressives. So I think that's one way of seeing the question.
You're talking about a kind of depression that is very extreme. You're not talking about a few days of not feeling yourself and being sad. So would you describe the kind of clinical depression that you mean when you use the word depression?
At the core of depression is a state where people are really disabled. That is, they're ruminative, they feel guilty about things they ought not to feel guilty about, they may be desperately suicidal, they feel empty and depleted, they have a very narrow range of affect. It's not that they're passionately sad. They often cannot grieve if they suffer a loss during the period of depression. Now, the way we make the diagnosis is a much more limited way. You have to have 2 weeks of moderate symptoms, and those symptoms include things like sadness and inability to experience pleasure and sleep and appetite changes and so on. But it turns out that people who have 2 weeks of those moderate symptoms, most such people actually have the more severe thing that I'm talking about. And that describes an episode of depression. But most people who have an episode of depression have another one, and most who have two have many more. So we're talking about what really is a chronic, relapsing, and recurring disease. Now, that said, once we fully embrace depression as a disease, the way we embrace arthritis as a disease, then we may have a different feeling about more minor manifestations. We may worry that a more minor depression is really a prodrome, a lead-up to major depression. We may worry that it's some leftover symptoms, that it's a residue of depression that is going to lead to more episodes.
You want to see depression as a disease, and a disease hopefully that can be treated. In what sense is depression like a disease as opposed to a condition?
It's fully a disease, and I don't think it's a question of my wanting it. It's a question of the facts. I have been under pressure, as you can imagine, over the past 10 or 12 years to write another book that's like listening to Prozac and to be on the lookout for a new medication that has startling implications for our sense of self. And I think what I saw over those 10 or 12 years wasn't a change in treatments, but a change in this underlying condition that is in the scientific understanding of depression. And what has emerged on a number of fronts simultaneously, and it's a forceful body of information. The first bit of it is that it looks as if depression harms the brain. So that's one sort of information. It disorganizes parts of the brain that deal with emotion, maybe causes atrophy in parts of the brain that are involved with emotional memory. Another whole line of evidence has to do with depression's effect on organs other than the brain, so that depression makes you more liable to stroke and heart disease and disorders of the bone and blood components. It's really a multi-system disease that looks a lot like other multi-organ diseases, things like diabetes. So I think it looks very much like a disease. And then if you look at the public health information, it looks as if it causes more disability over lifetimes and throughout cultures than almost any disease we can name. You know, there was this surprising World Health Organization, Harvard Public Health School study that I think intended to find that things like infantile diarrhea were, you know, terrible diseases and we ought to put our money into preventing those in third world countries. And lo and behold, up on the radar in a position very close to the top comes depression, surprise to everyone. And it looks as if depression causes more disability over a lifetime than things like the various cancers or AIDS or heart disease. It's certainly well in their league. And even if you change the assumptions that are in those studies, which frankly are a little favorable to the mental illnesses in terms of, you know, assessing their severity, if you cut the assumptions by half, depression would be more disabling than diabetes and asthma combined. And it's true whether you look at advanced or developing countries.
Let's break down what you've been saying here. Let's start with the fact that you said that depression seems to be related to an atrophy of the brain. Can you describe what you're talking about there?
This is not absolutely sure, but there was an astonishing study that came out in the early 1990s by a very bright researcher, Yvette Chalin. She looked at women who were extremely healthy. They didn't have illnesses other than depression, and they didn't even have some of the lead-up conditions like high blood pressure that make a person vulnerable to illness. And she looked at parts of their brain with the newest forms of brain scanning, which are more subtle than forms that were available earlier. And parts of the brain seemed to atrophy with age, and in particular the hippocampus, which is of interest for reasons I'll mention in a minute, seems to get smaller with age in, you know, rodent studies. And in these women who were extremely healthy, the hippocampus did not get smaller as they got older. But the hippocampus was smaller if they had had more days of depression. And there was a linear relationship. The more depression you'd had, the more days of depression a woman had had, the smaller her hippocampus. And there were similar results in another part of the brain that's involved with emotion as well, the amygdala. So that was a very scary finding. And she later went and revised that study and looked at days of depression when a woman was not on antidepressant medication, and the fit was even better. So it was untreated depression that correlated with smallness in the hippocampus. So it was lifetime exposure to depression that was related to the small hippocampus, and there was a related loss of verbal memory. So it looked like depression was doing two things. it was attacking the brain, or there's some other possibility that starting with a small hippocampus wasn't good. And in addition, it looked like it was interfering with repair mechanisms. So depression was looking both like a vulnerability and like a paralysis of recovery.
So what would it mean to have a smaller hippocampus?
Well, it would mean a number of things, but in particular, the hippocampus is also involved in ending stress responses, so that there's a cycle that goes on when you're under stress acutely, which is you mobilize your fight or flight response, and you have stress hormones coming out of certain glands, like the adrenal gland, and you're ready to face a challenge. And then the challenge goes away, and the switch goes off, and you recover. People who are exposed to these stress hormones over a long time suffer all kinds of problems. If you have Cushing's disease, you have too much of these adrenal hormones, for instance. And people who have depression look to be in that state, that is, they have a stuck switch, and there's this vicious cycle, which is to say that if you're damaging the hippocampus, the very part of the brain that's meant to shut off that switch is now damaged, so that the stress response is more and more prolonged. And with exposure to those stress hormones over time, it may be that other parts of the brain come under attack as well, and there's a part called the prefrontal cortex that probably is also implicated. It's another part of the brain that looks disorganized in depression.
The stress response affects all kinds of other organs in the body. You want to talk a little bit about how, therefore, depression might affect other aspects of your health?
Yes. Depression looks like a multi-organ disease. What happens when you have a chronic stress response and you have this stuck switch and you're not able to turn off the stress response is that your adrenal gland grows larger. The result of having all these adrenal hormones flowing around is that your bones lose calcium, so that women who have had chronic depression and are not yet menopausal look more like post-menopause women in terms of the fragility of their bones. Your platelets are ready for you to be wounded as if you were about to enter a fight, so that the platelets, the blood platelets, these elements that are involved with clotting, become more sticky, and that makes you more vulnerable probably to strokes and heart disease. The results of this are that very probably people with chronic depression die young. So it looks as if we're probably looking at a very profound multi-system disease that may even affect people who themselves don't show this last step of the process, which is this gravely disabling ailment that involves a sense of emptiness and inadequacy.
I don't know, Peter Kramer, but after hearing you talk about depression and the effects of depression and stress on the body, I feel like I need an anti-anxiety pill. it's so worrisome. It's making me so nervous.
Well, maybe what you need is a quiet drive in your car and a good listen to the radio.
You know, there are different kinds of depression, and I think one theory is, you know, that some depression is caused biologically. It's caused by things happening in the brain chemistry or in the brain itself, and that other forms of depression are just, you know, understandable responses to things that have happened in your life, you know, the death of a loved one, the loss of a job, and that these kinds of depressions might be fundamentally different. The depression caused by life events is the kind of depression you might recover from, whereas mm-hmm. the kind of depression caused by brain chemistry is something that might continue through your life. So do you feel like you have a better understanding now about the difference between the two kinds of depressions and the different ways that psychiatrists should be treating them?
Well, researchers have struggled with this problem over decades, and they have wanted to make the kind of distinction you're making. And the data keeps getting in the way. Early on, it was thought that if you had a depression that was caused by genetics, that was a real depression. And these sort of neurotic, operatic, flamboyant depressions of people who are just sensitive and vulnerable were something else. But that distinction turned out to be hard to maintain, because the non-genetic depressions caused just as much risk. There was as much likelihood of subsequent depressions, as much risk of suicide, as much of these other things like heart disease as in the so-called genetic depressions. And the behavioral genetic studies, in the end, showed that a high biological likelihood to depression puts you a few depressions down the road, so that if you come to depression through stress, by your third depression, you're in fairly bad shape. Whereas if you come to depression through a very high genetic loading, your first depression may look like somebody else's third depression. But from there on out, the process looks very similar. And I think in the end, there is some sort of prejudice or stigma involved in the attempt to keep that distinction. After all, we don't say that an episode of asthma is justified because a person is under stress or because a person has run into a certain kind of allergen. And I do worry that this justification is an attempt to set aside what we really do know about depression.
And just to clarify again, when we're talking about depression, you're not talking about sadness. What are you talking about?
I'm talking about whatever it is that we're talking about. That is this thing that damages probably the hippocampus and the prefrontal cortex. And depression is identified through a symptom checklist, so that if you are suicidal and guilt-ridden and you can't enjoy things and you're tearful and you have trouble with sleep and appetite, if you have a certain intensity of those symptoms and certain numbers of them, certain choice among them, you get this diagnosis of being in an episode of major depression. And that's sort of the entry ticket. If you have enough episodes of major depression, you have recurrent depression. So that is what we're talking about. And one could have depression without being very sad. In fact, really throughout history, you know, if you look at the history of melancholy over centuries and millennia, sadness is not even necessarily the key factor in depression. It's this emptiness, hollowness, paralysis of action, lack of energy. It's a very clear, overwhelming condition.
Your book, Listening to Prozac, was published in 1993. Very important book, a bestseller. Doctors have learned, scientists have learned a lot about depression since then. But we're still using some of the same medicines you wrote about in 1993, such as Prozac. Do you feel like now that we know more about depression, are these medicines still as effective as you once thought that they were?
I never thought that Prozac was particularly effective against depression. And listening to Prozac isn't mainly about depression. I think one reason I wrote this book against depression is to enter that territory and face depression head on. Listening to Prozac was about the possibility that we would have medications to affect fairly minor conditions and even to alter personality. And I wrote in Listening to Prozac that Prozac was probably less effective against major depression than some of the older medicines that have less well-tolerated side effects. So no, I think our armamentarium is not as good as it should be. That said, since depression looks more dangerous, we are probably justified in using what interventions we have quite vigorously. And we're reasonably good at treating depression. I mean, if you look at the data on any one drug, usually these medicines have very marked effects in 50 to 60% of people. But that's just one medication in a fairly sanitized trial where, you know, doctors are limited in how they can prescribe the medicine. If you would look at the overall effect of psychiatric intervention under the best circumstances, so you could give psychotherapy with medication, you could add a second medicine or change medicines, I think, you know, our ability to interrupt an episode of depression is fairly good. And we're, in fact, surprised and frustrated if we can't do that. For most patients, we can.
Do you think that there will be a new wave of antidepressants that scientists create pretty soon that will be much more effective in dealing with depression?
I think that sooner or later there will be much more effective medications. It's very hard to predict the time course of introductions of medicines. You know, during the last 10 years, there's been a lot of interest in stress hormones and interrupting the attack of stress hormones on the brain. And there are medicines that are quite capable of doing that, but they have such marked side effects that it's not possible to give them to people. So the question is when one can develop a medicine that does what we'd like medicines to do and yet, you know, have them be well tolerated. Now, if we get those medicines, there will be interesting ethical and moral conundrums about when to give them. For instance, if you could give a medicine that would make it so that a child who lost his parent did not have the brain effects of that loss, that is, wasn't predisposed, say, you know, if one imagines that this is the case, to later episodes of depression or anxiety disorders. Would you give that medicine in that case? And is that different, say, than a case of a very vulnerable person who loses a spouse and has to go on in life? Is it different from cases of rape? So I think if we could break the link between stressors and various kinds of mental effects, we'd be faced with then, you know, when do we want to do that?
There's been a lot of concern lately, even, I believe, a congressional inquiry into how antidepressants can make teenagers suicidal. How do you interpret the latest information on that?
I think it's for the good. That is, I think that those worries will make doctors have more appointments with their patients. I think it always was inappropriate, if this was going on, to give adolescents some medicine and say, you know, come back in a month and we'll see how you're doing. So I think on a public health basis, that concern is good. That said, I always have particular worries when it comes to depression that people don't look at the downside. That is, we're looking at medicines that have a certain degree of risk attached to them, and at a disease that has a great deal of risk attached to it. And on a public health basis also, if you look where these medicines have been introduced, there have been lots of public health studies looking at what happens when a country starts to license medicines like Prozac, and whether it's in New Zealand or the Scandinavian countries or certain counties in the United States where these medicines become more used, you see a decrease in suicides, and in particular you see a decrease in adolescent suicide, and you see that even where other markers of sort of turmoil like public alcoholism and so on don't go down. So it looks as if on a public health basis these new antidepressants are among the very few things we know of that actually decrease suicidality across the society. They do probably better than things like suicide hotlines, just taken as a simple intervention. But I do think it's going to be very important for doctors to, you know, be very careful with depressed patients, given whatever intervention they give. And, you know, very likely in the older age groups, antidepressants are going to be part of that. The medicines are just less effective also with children and adolescents, which is a separate problem.
Now, I want to go back to where we started, which is the fact that a lot of people seem concerned that if we found a way to do away with depression, we would also be wiping out something very important in our culture, which is alienation, a level of introspection that seems very related to artistic endeavors of every sort. And basically you're saying people are very romantic about depression in a way that they are not romantic about other diseases. And I'm wondering what you think it is about depression that has created this kind of almost aura around it.
I compare it partly to tuberculosis. You know, if you have a disease that has people wasting away slowly and that affects people of all ages and all social classes, you develop romantic myths around it. And we've had depression as part of the human capability for millennia. And, I think the result is a complicated one, both that there's some attraction in attributing romance to this condition, and that we just have too long a history that it's embedded in our notion of what the self-aware person is. I think Hamlet gets some of the blame, that there happened to be a great fashion in melancholy in the Renaissance, and it happens that the signal iconic literary figure of our culture is a deep melancholic. And I wonder what a culture would look like that was very much less liable to depression. I think that, you know, if I had to say that, you know, where my novelist's mind was as I was writing Against Depression, where the sort of creative originality is in this book, I think it's in thinking about this question of whether maybe we do overvalue things like alienation. And, I was challenged by a philosopher, actually, in writing about whether we ought to give Prozac to Sisyphus, rolling his rock endlessly up the hill. And I went back to the Camus essay, and of course Camus says that Sisyphus is happy. We need to imagine Sisyphus happy, that there is joy in, you know, knowing something about the absurdity of our condition, or that our awareness of absurdity comes from how joyous our lives are, even in the face of the stresses that are placed on us. And I thought, how could someone have forgotten that? And the reason that people forget that Sisyphus is joyous is that we have condensed this metaphor of depressive and deep, and have started to believe that depth is automatically related to depression. And I think that's not so.
Have you ever seen Sisyphus as a metaphor for obsessive compulsive syndrome? Doing the same thing over and over and over again without it being, you know, productive in the literal sense?
I see Sisyphus as an icon of freedom. I think that the notion that we can retain our autonomous thought, even in the face of very terrible punishments imposed on us, is really the saving grace about the human condition in the modern world.
Peter Kramer, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Peter Kramer is the author of the new book, Against Depression.